What if the trade war kicked up a notch, like a really big notch, actually, and the overall response was, yeah, so? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 10th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Tariffs, as you have surely heard by now, on about $200 billion in Chinese imports went from 10 to 25% at a minute past midnight this morning, Washington time. This round of negotiations has come to an end. We are told President Trump and his top advisors say the talks were constructive. And so here we are, betwixt and between. Gina Smilek's at the New York Times. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. The topic at hand, of course, is now what happens. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, let me start with you and offer this observation. It seems like the president, based on his statements and his tweets this afternoon, in which he basically said, tariffs are staying on. We'll see what happens. He's settling in for this thing to go for a while, no?
Yeah, it looks like it. And I mean, there were negotiations yesterday and today, and those only lasted a few hours. Both of the leaders in this case, both President Xi and President Trump, are dealing with a situation where they have decent-looking economies mm-hmm. and decent-looking markets at their back. And so I don't think there's a lot to push them to a really fast conclusion at this point.
Lynette, let me ask you this, actually, which just sort of occurred to me as Gina was making her point. You know how financial crises happen very slowly and then they happen all at once? Is it possible that a trade war goes along quietly for a long time and then gets worse very quickly all at once?
I don't see why not. And I'm not sure how stable the Chinese economy is. I mean, back in January, you wouldn't have said that. It was completely puking, yeah. And the government had to go in and help out banks and take some measures, like lowering the amount of cash that banks have to have on hand and encouraging the property market again, which is already very mm-hmm. frothy. So that's a worry that they have. Yeah, it's stable and it's been stable for the last month, but it took a lot of doing to get there yeah. and they pulled a lot of levers. So you don't want to go into a situation where it's destabilized again.
Yeah, I'd have thought, Gina, that and I did think, actually, I'll say it in the affirmative, that this time kind of felt a little bit different. I mean, we've been, up and down the tariff road with the president many times over the past 18 months. This one sort of felt more significant. And now, as I said up top in the open, everybody's kind of going, yeah, well, we'll see.
Right? Yeah, so I think it's interesting. I've been reading a lot of economist notes this afternoon. And the big takeaway I have from those is that most people just don't think that we're in for the long haul here. Like a lot of people think this does get resolved and that's why markets are shrugging this off. But like you said, if you listen to what the president is saying and look at what he's tweeting, it sounds like he is in for the long haul. And so that disconnect is going to be really interesting to watch and see how that gets resolved over the coming weeks, I think.
Lynette, I need some perspective from you on this one. Even a 25% tariff on $200 billion worth of imports comes to $50 billion, a huge, enormous amount of money. But in the scale of the American economy, it's a drop, right?
Yeah. I mean, sure. You're talking about a lot of goods everybody buys every day potentially being affected. And And you're talking about, potentially slowing down purchasing power a little bit. But the reality is the U.S. economy can probably handle this. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump knows that. One of the reasons, according to reports, that the Chinese delegation thought they could play harder ball was because the president kept insisting that the Federal Reserve should keep interest mm-hmm. rates low, which mm-hmm. is an indication that the economy is weak. So even though Donald Trump knows that the economy is strong or says that the economy is strong and the data is showing that we're on good footing right now. The fact that he was putting on pressure on the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates was giving a mixed signal to delegates. And they thought that maybe in reality the economy was weaker than right. it is, and they had an entrance point yeah. to negotiate.
So Gina, let me ask you this, and it has been pointed out here and elsewhere that the president of the United States is economically inconsistent, shall we say, and this is actually a really serious question. Do you think the president understands how tariffs work? Because if you look at his public statements and his utterances on Twitter, it's not clear.
Right. So he's saying things like, you know, tariffs are being paid to the U.S. by China of 25% on $250 billion of goods. That's not the way tariffs work. So the way tariffs work is that in tariffs can work different ways. But the way these tariffs have worked so far is that the people paying them are domestic right. consumers. And the research up to this point shows that literally the full incidence, like all of these tariffs are being paid by domestic consumers to the tune of like $1.4 billion by the end of 2018, based on the research so far. And so I think that, you know, there's a real disconnect between what he's saying and what is actually happening with these tariffs.
Lynette, same question to you. Do you believe the president understands how tariff works?
Based on what he says, no.
Yeah.
But does he mean what he says? I don't know.
Huh.
You know, either he's performing that he doesn't or he really doesn't.
Yeah. Super quick question to both of you on the way out here. I'm obliged to point out that there's paperwork in the works looking at automobile tariffs on the European Union. We've got the USMCA that the president has said he wants to wrap up by the end of the summer. We've got a debt limit fight coming sooner rather than later. Why does anybody think they're going to be able to devote any attention to that when this is still hanging over their heads? Gina, you go first.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the interesting question is whether people think this is still going to be hanging over their heads. And so I think that a lot of, especially, you know, the universe I work in, a lot of economists just think this does get resolved because the stakes are pretty high and because the next tranches of tariffs are going to hit consumers, whereas the ones up to this point have been on sort of business intermediary goods. And so I think there's this idea that this is just going to get resolved. Whether that's true, I don't know.
Lynette, same question to you quickly. You think it's going to get fixed with all the rest of the stuff they're promising to work on?
I don't know if they're going to get to anything. There's too much going on in Washington, and I would like to be bored with Washington. But it's too exciting, and I don't like it. This is a very complicated situation. I've been talking to people on Wall Street since Sunday, President Trump tweeted out all that stuff.
Yeah.
And on Monday, anybody would have told you that we wouldn't be where we are today. On Tuesday, they were starting to get a little worried. And on Wednesday, they were like, oh, my God, this is real. So nobody actually knows. This is happening in real time, and the experts are we've gone into uncharted territory here with the significance of these tariffs.
And we have gone over time. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider and Gina Smilek at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, soothed, I believe you could say traders were, by the president's comments about negotiations, as Lynette was alluding to. They're down a ton at the open, up a bit at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the Marketplace desk of Timing is Everything, we bring you now the latest tech IPO. Uber started trading today, the most anticipated initial public offering since Facebook, probably, right? Didn't go so good, off 7.5% on day one. Rival Lyft, meanwhile, has lost nearly a third of its value since it went public back in March. Yes, the markets have been turbulent of late, but we asked Marketplace's Kimberly Adams to unpack why investors are really a little jittery about the ride-sharing business.
Look, investing in an IPO is a gamble. Buying any stock is, really. But you want to be somewhat confident that gamble is going to pay off down the road, which is why people are looking hard at Uber's business model.
It is money losing right now, which is just a way of saying they're paying us to use it.
Mihir Desai is a finance and law professor at Harvard. He points out that Uber has been subsidizing rides, paying bonuses to drivers, and covering other big expenses with venture capital at first, and now capital from the equity markets.
That is sustainable for a little while you're growing. The question is whether they can get off ever doing that.
To actually start making money, Uber will likely have to raise prices for riders and cut driver pay, says Rachel Binder, who covers the automotive and mobility industries for CB Insights. And ultimately,
the way that the company will become profitable is largely dependent on if they can get rid of the drivers completely, which will rely on self-driving technology.
And there's not really a firm timetable for when that will happen, or when it does, how much money it will actually save. Harry Campbell drives for Uber and Lyft and blogs at The Rideshare Guy.
Companies are talking about the self-driving narrative, but until they don't need drivers, they really need drivers more than anything.
Drivers who want their own piece of Uber's potential profitability and even went on strike for it earlier this week. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
In retail news today, the mood at the party supply chain Party City is less than entirely festive. The company says it's going to close 45 stores, about 5% of its locations this year. That's a lot more than the usual turnover. You could say Party City's problems are a result of deflation of a slightly different kind. Sales have been dropping thanks in part to a global shortage of helium. Not what you want to run out of when nearly 20% of your business is pre-filled balloons and helium tanks. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on the surprisingly big business of party balloons.
The helium tanks were getting a workout at my local Party City today, with graduation and birthday balloons in high demand. But when Rose Rangel found out it would cost $40 to rent her own tank for a baby shower, she headed for Walmart. She had to have helium.
Yeah. Up in the air balloons, better than tagging them like at the olden days.
I get it. I have an array of My Little Pony and Star balloons slowly sinking in my house right now. Somebody turned 5 this week. But balloons aren't just kids' stuff. David Adler is CEO of BizBash, a trade website for corporate event planners. He says about 3 years ago,
all of a sudden, balloons went from, you know, the people wouldn't be caught dead with balloons to, oh my God, look what they're doing with balloons.
What they're doing, elaborate archways and sculptures, doesn't require helium. Desiree Ontiveros is founder of Badass Balloon Company in New Orleans. On one of her first big jobs, the event space didn't allow helium balloons because they didn't want workers chasing flyaways. So she got creative, building installations with air-filled balloons.
We use everything that you could possibly imagine. Tape, string, rope, hooks, nails, everything.
She recently did a Mardi Gras party with more than 30,000 balloons for $100,000. Jonathan Pincheski owns Lighter Than Air in Lexington, Kentucky. He says he used to rent out a large tank of helium for $89. Now it's $268. But it hasn't hurt his business.
I am so busy, I can't hardly take time out to talk to you. Business is booming, but not with helium balloons.
He makes his art with air. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
LVMH, that's Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, the world's biggest luxury brand, said today it is going to launch a new fashion house with Rihanna. That's pop superstar Rihanna. Clothes, shoes, accessories, the whole smash. In addition to Louis Vuitton, LVMH holds Christian Dior and Givenchy, among others. But Rihanna's Fenty Maison, as it's going to be called, will be the group's first new fashion house since 1987. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
Legacy firm LVMH is already home to Rihanna's makeup line Fenty Beauty. That brought in more than $500 million in sales last year. So, collaborating again with a young pop superstar whose fans follow her every fashion move? Smart play, says Kit Yarrow, a consumer psychologist.
Oh, they so desperately needed to do this because luxury needed a shakeup. It's really been dominated by men. It's been dominated by tradition. It's been dominated by hyper skinny models, a lack of diversity.
And Rihanna is a Black woman who's established herself in an emerging market. Her cosmetics come in dozens of brown shades. Her lingerie brand, Savage X Fenty, uses plus-size models. Miles Socha, editor-in-chief at Women's Wear Daily, says the partnership is a good match because LVMH,
has an international reach, you know, manufacturing expertise in leather goods, fashions, you name it, prime real estate at their disposal.
And says Socha, this is emblematic of how superstars are changing the game. Stars like Rihanna don't just license out their names, they own and design their own lines, says Tomai Sudari, marketing professor at NYU. And she notes the fashion industry has had bad PR with racially insensitive designs.
So I think it's really interesting to see how proactive LVMH has been in taking a stand and addressing the issue from the inside out with the acquisition.
It isn't clear what the price point for Fenty Maison is going to be yet, but as a luxury brand, it'll probably be a stretch for most of us. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They hate her when they're with her and they miss her when they're gone.
Living and working on the river. But first, let's do the numbers. Down 300-ish at the open, the Dow recovered 114 points to the good, 0.4%, 25,942. The Nasdaq ticked up 6 points today, less than 0.1%, 79.16. The S&P 500 found 10 points in the couch cushions, 0.3%, 28.81. For the week, though, we should do a record scratch here on the music, actually. The Dow off 2.1%. S&P 500 the same. The Nasdaq down 3%. Like we told you earlier, shares of Uber down 7.6% today. First day of trading. Lyft sank 7.4%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.46%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lot of American farmers thought this was going to be a pretty good week, that maybe China and the United States might find a way out of the trade war, a trade war that agriculture has been hit especially hard by. That, as we now know, was not to be, so we got Brian Duncan back on the phone. He's the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau and a regular source of what is really going on out there, wisdom for us. Hey, Mr. Duncan, it's Kai Rizdahl in Los Angeles. Sir, how are you?
Hey, good, Kai. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time. Let me get your gut reaction, then, to the latest development in American trade policy. What do you think?
Well, it's not what we'd hoped for, right? I think agriculture came into, Sunday morning, hoping that today would provide the end of what's been a tumultuous road and, a road that's seen agriculture take a pretty hard financial hit. And then starting Sunday evening with the tweet,
yeah,
and then the market response, it hasn't been the week we've hoped for. Let's just put it that way, Kai.
Let me ask you something. You do hogs and soybeans, right?
Yeah, hogs, soybeans, and corn.
How are the prices for, let's pick soybeans. How you doing?
Well, not good. Soybeans and corn, and I see the market's down hard today.
Yeah.
I think we had a stocks report, and the world's awash in grain, and now we're not going to be able to sell, it looks like. But hogs have rallied because of the fears of the swine fever in China, yeah, and their need, and they have come in and purchased a little pork. You know, now if there's follow through with those purchases based on today's developments, I guess we just wait and see. I guess what we're asking is when's the other shoe drop now? What do they retaliate with? And what's the next move for agriculture? Kai, we needed a win. We needed some relief. And where's that going to come from?
Well, you could probably get, the Secretary of Agriculture on the phone, Mr. Duncan. What would you tell him?
Well, that's a great question. I know Vice President Pence last night talked about another round of tariff aid for farmers,
yeah,
and that's not what any farmer wants to hear. We'd rather get our money from the marketplace, but the reality is we're going to need help. We've got bills to pay. We've been given a lot of promises on trade deals, and so far nothing, and promises don't pay the bills, Kai, and farmers are telling me that.
So look, how much longer can you, deal with this? I mean, at some point, it's got to have serious impact on you and your members and the folks there in Illinois with you.
It's already happening. We've got dairy farmers that are not able to hold on. They've run out of runway.
Hmm.
Good producers, Kai, good farmers that are just not able to hang on any longer. And I think there'll be some grain farmers and other livestock farmers next. The hog industry, I guess we are hopeful that there's still solid demand for protein going forward, but everybody is very nervous right now, Kai, and I'm not sure where the win is going to be for us, but we're in desperate need.
This is going to sound like I'm taking a poke at the president, but I'm really not. Do you think he understands the impact of these tariffs on your slice of this economy?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how complete the understanding is. I mean, I think that he's aware of it, and there's some discussion at the White House level about it. I'm certain of that. Yet he seems to have an agenda that is willing to sacrifice agriculture in pursuit of that agenda. There's been a lot of promises, and this morning he promised a big commodity buy.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we'll see. I don't know what that looks like. So we'll see. I hope he does understand.
Brian Duncan, he's the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, also does hogs and soybeans and corn, as you heard, all by himself out there in Illinois. Mr. Duncan, thanks very much for your time.
I've got a good family.
Yeah, yeah, you
do.
You're not doing it all yourself. That is that is totally true. That is true. Thanks for your time, sir. We appreciate it.
Always great to talk to you.
Also on our regulars list is a guy by the name of Austin Golding. He runs the family business, Golding Barge Lines, down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. We have talked over the past 4 or 5 years, Austin and I, about infrastructure and tariffs, the tax bill, the weather as well. Here he is from a couple of weeks ago.
Well, right now we're actually dealing with mostly flood conditions up and down the Mississippi River. You know, it looks like in June we may get some relief.
One thing we haven't talked a whole lot about, though, is life on the river, what it's like living and trying to make a living out there in a not very high-profile economic engine. So we called his mom. Her name is Melody Golding. She's a documentarian and a photographer. She's got a new book out as well. It's oral histories from the people who make America's riverboats go. It's called Life Between the Levees. Melody, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Kai. Appreciate you having me.
It's a true pleasure to talk to you. I would like you, if you would, to start by telling me about the second date you had with a man who is now your husband.
Oh, well, we caught a towboat on the river and rode from Vicksburg to Natchez. It was a memorable trip that set the course for my life for the rest of my life.
Tell me what it is about the river. I mean, other than the man you married, tell me about what it is about the river that made you get into this lifestyle and appreciate it so much.
The river has a lure. It calls people. You know, all water calls people to its shores, and people who work on the river will tell you that. They hate her when they're with her, and they miss her when they're gone.
What was it that made you want to tell these stories of the folks in this book?
I want to tell people about a way of life on the river. It's working men and women who, without whom the nation would come to a halt. I knew that there was a story out there to be told, and I knew that I could tell it. An ordinary person can't get out on the river and talk to people. It's kind of a closed society. You have to have, it's kind of like a rite of passage to be able to go out on the river and talk to these people.
It is a story that you tell through time. I think you arrange the oral histories in this book by date of birth of the person that you're talking to. I think it goes from like 1917, right, up 70-something years.
Yes.
And part of what's interesting about that is the way river boating and the barge industry has changed over time. I mean, it's busier now, it's more dangerous, the boats are more physical, and it's more economically vital to this country.
Yes, it is. A lot of the pilots were broke in by early steamboat pilots from the late 1800s. Hmm. And then the later pilots in the book, the younger pilots, are in the 21st century world of technology and satellite, computer, and GPS. I mean, it's a whole different world now than what it was 72 years ago.
You know, one of the things I talk to Austin about every now and then when we have him on is who comes out and who does these jobs. And it's interesting because you find a lot of folks in this book are got in it early, and then because it is can be such a good lifestyle economically, they stay in it, even though it means time away from their families.
That's true. Of course, some people do love the river and they love being out there. But the money does make people stay. They can provide their family with a livelihood that they wouldn't be able to otherwise. It's a way of life that most landlubbers have no idea that's out there. There's a culture of people out there within the heartland of America who are making our country gin. They're making it work.
Do you really call us landlubbers?
Yeah, I'm kind of a landlubber too.
Melody Golding's book is called Life Between the Levees, America's Riverboat Pilots. We talk to her son every now and then as well. Melody, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai. I appreciate you having me.
This final note on the way out today, in honor of Mother's Day on Sunday and courtesy of the Social Security Administration. Every year around this time, Social Security releases its list of the most popular baby names in the country. For the second year in a row last year, it was Liam for boys, Emma for girls. Kai, by the way, number 113 on the list last year. That's for boys. For girls, 854th. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 114 points today. That's 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 6 points, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500, 10 points to the good, 0.3%. For the week, though, the Dow off 2.1%. The S&P 500, the same. The NASDAQ down 3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.